Today we have a special guest here with us. Her name is
Allie.
Allie and I have been friends for a long time. I'm really thankful to have her here with us today. So, Allie, if you want to go ahead and just tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm Allie. I'm 30. I live in Bakersfield. I've lived here for about 18 years. And before that, I lived a lot of different places. I was born in Riverside, but I lived in a lot of places where there was Border Patrol locations because my stepfather at the time was a Border Patrol agent, so we relocated quite often. So I was never really in one place for too long until I was about 11 or 12. That's when I moved to Bakersfield.
And how long would you consider yourself to be in recovery?
5 to 6 years. I don't really have a date because I stopped when I ran out and it wasn't easily accessible for me.
So I know you mentioned that you moved around a lot. You lived here for 18 years. Where were you living when you were in elementary school?
Everywhere. I lived Riverside, San Bernardino, Palm Desert, Indio, Brawley, El Centro. I was never one place, so it was really hard for me to kind of stay somewhere and kind of let my roots grow because it was I never stayed in one place too often.
Okay. And how was that? Did you like that? Was that difficult for you?
I hated it.
Okay.
I think it really made it difficult for me to connect with people. It made it difficult for me to make friends because you just, at some point in my childhood, I kind of given up on making friends because it was just so frustrating to build these connections with somebody. This was way before social media.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, if you change house numbers, then and you lost that house number, you're, you know, essentially screwed.
You're
and
disconnected, yep.
And maintaining that friendship at that time. So until I moved to Bakersfield when I was at the end of my sixth grade year was when I kind of started to feel okay.
That's really hard, especially as a kid, because you're totally powerless. Like, you don't have a voice in any of those changes. Yeah. So at what point in your life would you say you first became aware of substances? At elementary school, junior high, high school?
Elementary school. My mom, she's a recovering alcoholic. She just stopped drinking, I want to say, 3 years ago. But she's always drank. Mm-hmm. A lot of my family drinks. It's normal.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up around alcohol, and that was the only thing I really knew as a substance. It wasn't until middle school where I was introduced to other things other than alcohol.
Okay, and what were those other things?
In middle school, I did more than I should have. You know, you would think that maybe you would start drinking, but I drank and I smoked weed and I tried cocaine for the first time in middle school. And in high school, I didn't do anything. But in middle school, I had a boyfriend whose older brother was a dealer, so that's when I experimented with it, just because it was accessible for us. You know, it was a very toxic 7th, 8th grade relationship, but we both, like me and my boyfriend at the time, did not graduate junior high. Mm-hmm. We just kind of got promoted to high school. We were just bad kids, and I did a lot of bad things because I just wanted that attention from him.
How did he introduce that to you? Was that something you knew when you guys met, or was that something that happened gradually as the relationship grew?
I knew that he smoked weed. He was just one of those cool kids that smoked weed. He really didn't introduce me to anything. It was kind of his group around him. And he was like, whatever, you can do it if you want. The first time I smoked weed was in a bathroom at the school. It was a blunt with a black and mild, and I'll never forget it. It was with the most person that was completely polar opposite of me, but we were very cool with each other, and she was friends with my boyfriend, and that's when I first started smoking weed. And then I started smoking with him because I'm like, now I do this. We can do this together. This is one thing that we can do together. And then when we started hanging out more, I met his family, and his brother was like, well, you guys can do this. Like, you can try this. Which, looking back at it, at the time, he was probably 17. His older brother was 17, and we were 12, 13 years old. Mm-hmm. And I can't even imagine somebody at 17 offering a 12-year-old cocaine. And we just did it just because it was his brother and I trusted him and I trusted his brother. And that was just what I did with my partner.
Well, it sounds like there was a lot of influences there, because even though there's a huge age gap between 12, 13, and 17, he's still essentially a teenager as well. So in order to be dealing it at 17, he had to have been getting it from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to take it back a little bit and talk about your label as bad kids. Is that something you considered yourself to be then, or is that something that you're looking at now and saying, oh, I was a bad kid?
I think it was my label. I was a very... I don't even know what the word is. I would push back on my dad.
Rebellious.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was very rebellious of him, and my dad was not around.
Mm-hmm.
And I had lived with my mom, and I got pulled out of my mom's house through the courts and kind of just got stuck with my dad. And I don't think my dad was ready to be a full-time parent. So I rebelled on his parenting because I don't think he knew how to properly do it, and I was just seeking that attention. And my life had changed so much within those years, sixth grade, seventh grade, my life had changed completely. Teenager going through puberty with a single dad who just could not parent. I just did a lot of bad things. I don't think I was necessarily a bad kid. I just was not surrounded with positive influences. And I think that in my life, I need to be surrounded with positive influences. And later on in my life, I realized, it took me a really long time to realize, people that I surrounded myself with really influenced my paths with drugs.
Thanks for making that distinction, because when it comes to youth, there's always a huge thing surrounding labels and how they label themselves and how adults label them. So it's really important to be able to say, I'm accepting this label of who I was then, versus, no, this is what people were telling me, this is who I was.
Yeah.
You know, so it does, to me, I feel like it makes a big difference.
Yes.
See, and what I heard was that you had an insane amount of trauma in a very small amount of time.
Yes.
And you didn't know how to deal with any of it. So you weren't a bad kid by any stretch of the imagination. You were just having trouble coping.
Yes.
So I want to talk a little bit more about that. Let's talk about your life situation where you were removed from your mom.
First, my parents were never really together. Okay. So I grew up my whole life with knowing that they disliked each other a lot.
Okay.
So even the switching of the parents, like the meetup to switch me from going to my dad's to my mom's, was traumatic. Like, I was, had a dad on one arm, mom on the other, like pulling me like I'm a rag doll or something.
Like literally pulling me.
So that was kind of like the start of my childhood, and not having like a good parental situation, it was bitter and it was childish.
Even like that stability of feeling safe with one parent versus the other parent, it's like, I don't even know how I'm supposed to feel because they dislike each other so much.
And it was very manipulative when I think about the way that they talked about each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, your dad is this, your mom's a piece, you this. And it was all of these influences when I was really young that were just not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason that I got taken out of my mom's custody and put into my dad's was because my mom was a suicidal, depressed alcoholic, And she basically planned to kill the whole family. And she had this plan, I guess, in a notebook, and my stepdad at the time found it. And it was close all of the windows, make sure all the doors were locked and sealed, and turn on the propane and while we're sleeping, and give us medicine to sleep harder,
mm-hmm.
and just kill us through the propane fumes. So once he found that, he took it to my biological dad, and right away I was just pulled out. So I had no clue what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I had no clue that my mom was sick in that way.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was just not ready to be a parent like that, and imagining what he must have been feeling, knowing what my mom had planned to do, was probably traumatic as it is. So that was the start of my biggest trauma, was that instance.
And when did you find out that that is what she had been planning to do?
In sixth grade, I was in school, and I got called up to the principal's office on the intercoms. I was like, ooh.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm walking, and there's cops, like 5 or 6 cops.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see my dad, and then I see my stepmom at the time. And I'm like, what is going on? Because I lived in Palm Desert, I think, at that time, and coming from Bakersfield, I'm like, why would they travel this far? It's not even their week to have me.
Right.
And then they're like, you're coming to live with us. The police kind of like told me like what had happened. My stepdad at the time was there, and he was like, you're never going to live with your mom again. This is why. That was it. I didn't get to go back to my house with my mom to get any of my things. I just kind of got pulled out and then placed with my dad.
That's pretty horrific. I'm sorry that happened to you. That's terrible. You have siblings, right?
Yes.
One brother?
I have 4 siblings.
Okay.
My mom, she had 2 other kids other than me. My little brother and sister, and they live with their dad. And then I have sister, my dad's daughter, and then my mom had another kid later on in life.
Okay, so you were relocated by yourself. You weren't relocated with any of your siblings?
No. At that point, I don't think my sister was born yet.
Okay, so it was just you.
Yeah.
So that's pretty traumatic, too, as the siblings you were living with went in a different direction.
Yes.
You said that was a 6th grade. And so when you had to transition, when you moved to dad's, when you had to move schools, was that the beginning of the rebellious stage? Or did that start coming a little bit later on? Because you mentioned 7th, 8th grade was the boyfriend year.
Yes.
So what did it take for that to occur? Was it just dad not knowing how to parent, a little bit of everything that was going on? How did that happen? Just tell me about that a little bit.
I think the biggest thing was probably right after I had gotten taken out. I went to go visit my stepdad. And my stepdad had my brother and sister. And this was, I think, 6th grade to 7th grade summer. So I was supposed to go over there for a couple weeks to go see my brother and sister again, because I basically got pulled out of 6th grade, put into another school right away. And obviously, I wasn't able to go back, like, to go see my brother and sister until summer. And that's when I was raped the first time, when I went back. And so that kind of really started my issues. Not only like it was like mom issues, but also now dad issues. Because my stepdad had raped me. And that really changed my life, from having this father figure in my life, having a mom, and having that person do that to me was taking away my brother and sister too. So I really feel like I lost my mom's family. And I think that's what really set me off to search for like love, attention.
Without knowing what any of those things look like either.
Yeah.
You never received a healthy version of that. Were you able to have help and support whenever you were sexually assaulted? Or did you keep that to yourself?
I did what you're supposed to do. Yeah. I told a family member, my cousin, who was just a couple years older than me, and she was like, Ali, you literally need to run away. Because I was in another town.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't in Bakersfield. I wasn't surrounded by any other family other than him. She's like, run. And I did. I literally, we were at a park, ran, hopped over a backyard, like a brick wall, and I was in like a country club neighborhood, and a security guard picked me up, took me. I did everything that you're supposed to do. The rape kit, the interview, the pictures, everything. And because of his job being in law enforcement, nothing ever happened. And I tried many years, even years later, after I realized that there wasn't like a limitation or a certain limitation on it, I tried to go back and get it looked at again. And everything that I had, my pictures, my rape kit, DNA, all of that was destroyed, like purposefully. So I'll never be able to get justice for that, because
that's so re-traumatizing.
But I also want to thank you for being so willing to share that.
Absolutely.
Because there are so many traumatic events that also happen to so many people who don't know what to do, or who also do the right thing with no outcome.
No. Your story is way too common, and people need to realize that sometimes you do everything you're supposed to do and it just does not work out how it's supposed to.
And it's sad, because you want to tell your children, this is what you need to do.
Exactly.
If you tell, you're going to be hurt.
Right.
And if you do all the right things and the right steps during the right time frame, that it's going to be okay. And a lot of the time it's not, and it's more often than not, and it's really, we need to change that, because then we're going to get to the point where nobody's telling.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, and as a survivor, all of that responsibility is put on you. You come forward, you're vulnerable, you risk all of this, you do this invasive mm-hmm. medical procedure, and then there's nobody there to support you with
exactly.
following through after you have made all yeah. of those sacrifices.
Yeah.
So that definitely takes us through the 7th, 8th grade, you know, what started going on with the boyfriend and the marijuana use and the cocaine use.
We have, you know, all of the total lack of protective factors in your
yes.
childhood. There was nobody on your side. You did not have any of the support that you so desperately needed, and were doing all of the correct things to get. But did you know the health effects or risks of smoking weed when you started? Like, have anybody talked to you about that?
I did, which is funny, and I should have brought it. You did the DARE program in the 6th grade. I have my speech that I gave, because you had to like write an essay about how the program like
yes.
affected you, and
uh-huh.
my speech won, like, out of all of the 6th grade. And I found it recently and I read it. Oh my gosh. I just can't even remember the words, but I was like, if you only knew.
Yeah.
Like, in DARE, they really only talk about, well, back then, they really only talked about smoking and drinking.
Right.
It was never anything that really, like, took effect on me. Like,
right.
My vice was pills. But they didn't talk about pills.
And
back
that
then,
wasn't even a thing.
That wasn't a thing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you said something that like really struck me. You said that after you smoked weed, you said, now this is something I do. Like, I do this now. We can do
yeah,
this together.
We can do this together.
And to me, like, that's always the problem I've had with those, like, making kids sign pledges when they're in sixth
right.
grade and don't understand what they're promising. It's like, as soon as you experiment with substances, you might as well be a full-blown drug addict in the eyes of DARE, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's completely abstinence only. There's no room for questioning or experimentation
yeah.
or anything. It's literally just don't do it at all, right?
Yeah.
As soon as you violated that essay, like, now
yeah.
I'm a pothead. Like, this is what I do.
I looked it up and I was like, oh, Officer Darby. He's so disappointed in me right now.
That's it, though. It's like a 0 to 60 so quick, because there's no room for that. Like, this is a thing I tried once, and, you know, it's not good for me. I'm not going to do it again. It's like, now I'm a burnout stoner.
Yeah.
You weren't. That's not
yeah.
what was happening. But this is what I do now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so important to recognize.
It is. But I just wanted to move forward into high school, because you said you didn't do anything in high
mm-hmm.
school. So how did you make the transition from, this is what I do now, to, I'm in high school, so this isn't what I do anymore?
Well, since I was not, you know, the model student in middle school, my dad put me into a Christian high school my freshman year. I didn't do drugs or I didn't drink because that was not what you did at the school. I was very, like, sneaky with my, like, actions. Mm-hmm. So I would be like, can I please, you know, I'm having a rough time. I really just want to talk to God right now. And they'll be like, yes. Go on. So I'd take all the time you need. And then I would leave campus and go to McDonald's. Because I wanted to pray, but I was going to do, get out of school. Like, it was just.
Got to McDonald's,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fine.
So we all do it, pray in different ways.
So I didn't do anything. I think, again, because the people that I was surrounded with, they really didn't. And that school was a poor, it wasn't like BCHS, which was cost more money, or
right.
Garces, which costs even more money than that. It was like the very affordable Christian high school to go to. So not everybody there was extremely wealthy like you would see in, you know, a different private school.
Right.
And I think that really just showed that the money thing wasn't, you know, able to go to drugs or alcohol,
okay.
Because the people didn't really have it.
It wasn't accessible. Okay, so the affordability of it was the reason.
Granted, our school only had 100 students for the whole entire school.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was like 25
so
person
small.
Per class,
okay.
Essentially, each grade.
And so, quick disclaimer, though, nothing against these private schools. This is just the personal experience.
So the Christian school that you were moved to, what did your friends look like there?
Just normal.
They weren't using substances?
No.
That wasn't something you talked about?
No. It was really that school, I kind of just talked about how I was off of it now.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That was my story. But then that school shut down my freshman year. So then I had to go to Foothill.
So how was that transition from 100 student school to here's public school with,
I think it was 2,000
yeah.
people at Foothill. Mm-hmm. And it was a culture shock, really, because I just never, that was not my impression of high school.
Mm-hmm.
My freshman year was not a realistic version of what a high school was. And then that was kind of tough too, going to some place where I knew everybody and you had a relationship with every single person
mm-hmm.
in that school, to going somewhere where there's hundreds of people compared to 100.
Mm-hmm.
And there was so many different people. The athletic team, there was, what are those people that work with the agriculture? Gosh, what is they called?
4-H kids.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, I guess 4-H would be probably the most accurate. And then there was like drama and band. We didn't have band at Valley. It was just very traumatic to see what. It wasn't traumatic. I guess it was really just a culture shock to see of all of these people, and there's so many different people and so many different type of people. Then there's people that actually smoke weed, and then there's people that actually drink here, and I didn't know
mm-hmm.
any of that. But I think my friend group was my boyfriend, really, at the time.
Yeah.
It really was. I mean, I have friends, obviously.
Friendly.
I have friends, but I really stayed with my boyfriend most of high school, so that was my friend group, really.
But I'll go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and it's you getting uprooted and losing all of your friend groups again and starting over. Like,
mm-hmm.
that's really difficult, especially in high school.
Yeah. And this was, like, the start of social media this time.
Okay.
This was really when, like, MySpace first started, so there was more. There was more.
We're so old.
It really started like a lot more social distractions
mm-hmm.
and issues for when you're a teenager to have like social media and worrying about. who's commenting on your picture and who's on your top eight and all of these things. Right. That
social competitiveness, almost. Yeah. I remember that because you used to have to rank your friends. Yeah. And everyone could see that. Yeah. Oh my gosh, I totally forgot about that.
Yeah. But, okay, so you mentioned that going into high school, it was mainly boyfriend all throughout. Was there anything specific that brought you back to that 7th, 8th grade state of, oh, I'm a smoker, this is what I do? Mm-hmm. Or was it just nothing up until graduation? Like, nothing?
I don't think I touched anything until college, probably.
Yeah.
And my boyfriend didn't smoke, he didn't drink, he was a band geek.
Yeah,
so, I mean, I guess people did that, but it was just, again, he was the main person that I was around, and so we didn't. And no desire wasn't around us. My dad was pretty strict in high school, probably because I had a boyfriend, so I think I was also scared of getting in trouble too. But in high school, I just had no desire. Wasn't even a thought in my mind that, oh, this is what I need to do. I don't think I went to one party in high school. I didn't do anything crazy at all.
I don't think so.
So then you mentioned that your dad was really strict. How was your home dynamic at that point? Were you guys getting along better?
No. Absolutely.
No. No hesitation on that. Okay.
He was a very strict dad. Again, I don't think he really realized that you probably needed help from your village to raise a girl and a teenage girl.
Right.
I think he just had these things that he wished I wouldn't be. And once I started creeping onto those lines of things that he disliked, he kind of lost his mind. He just does not have a very good temper. So it was very frustrating to have to be on eggshells a lot in your life.
I want to note that you spent a lot of time with your boyfriend at the time, and that was kind of a pattern because you had your 7th, 8th grade boyfriend who you just dove right in and were with for a long time. And then after that relationship ended, that was your first kind of toxic type of relationship. But then in high school, that was another long-term pretty much relationship. So you were digging into these relationships in a sense.
Yes.
And I think that's really important because a lot of times when people don't have their village or they try to find those people.
Yes.
In people. And not that those people are bad, you know what I mean? Not that it's wrong or they're wrong. But I just think it's really important to note that it happens.
I think I found myself searching for that love and connection.
Right.
And I think when you don't have men in your life that are good and teaching you about love and respect, and my first boyfriend loved the hell out of me, but we were just doing very bad things. My second boyfriend, I'm sure he loved me. We have a wonderful kid together. We were together for a long time. But I think we just were together just to be together. It wasn't together for a good relationship. It wasn't a bad relationship, but it wasn't a good one either. It wasn't realizing that we shouldn't be in this relationship because we're not compatible. It was just, I like you, you like me, now I love you, now you love me. Mm-hmm. Let's just stick it out until we can't.
But at the time, we don't think that.
No.
You know, this comes later on in life. It's always like, I love you forever. It is.
And I don't think you really think about all of the things that I absolutely dislike about my son's father. I just, like, ignored
Like, that denial, like, or the naiveness.
Like, we've been together since we were 15 years old.
Yeah.
Naivety.
There we go.
Yeah, I knew what you meant.
And everybody expected it, Allie and Santana, forever. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it just didn't work out like that. And it didn't, we stayed in longer than we needed to. But I think I always have had this underlying feeling or thing in my head where I don't want my relationship to fail. Like, if I'm going to commit to you, I'm committed to you. And I don't want to fail in that. I don't want to fail in that aspect of it. And it wasn't until later on in life that I'm like, I realized it, but I just stayed longer than I need to in a lot of relationships and in a lot of situations. I didn't need to be in that place as long as I did, but I didn't want to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to lose that partner.
It's the attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the attachment stems back from the trauma.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also control, too, because mm-hmm. you can control when you leave. As Absolutely. Long as you're still in that relationship, not only have you not given up, but you're controlling that you're still there. That's really hard.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. But that relationship passed.
Mm-hmm. And I think that brings us up to college years, right?
Yes.
Okay, so walk us through that a little bit.
College?
That's how all of us think about college. Like, college.
I was like, woo! It's a blur.
It really is a blur. This go into, like, the people that I surrounded myself with. So I had a friendship with a couple of people that I loved, and they were good to me and were good friends, but we just did bad things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think being in college, we were both young, me and this other person were both young moms,
mm-hmm.
and I think we both kind of wanted to experience the college experience and go out and drink and party, and I did that for a long time, and it was getting really tiring,
mm-hmm.
and I was really neglecting myself as a mother, and I was not being the best parent that I could have. I was really worried about where I'm gonna drink next, and I would drink, binge drink every weekend. I would drink at school, I would drink before a final, I drank, and I popped pills, and I smoked weed, and I did mushrooms. I was just going out and living my best life for a long time. And I got into this relationship with this older man. And it really changed my life in a lot of ways. And I think Bianca will say that relationship was not good for me.
It was not good for her.
But I loved that relationship because it took me out of one aspect of my
right.
life. Mm-hmm. It took me out of that party aspect, and it kind of put me back into a motherly aspect. And I don't think I really know for sure that I did not realize how bad it was until years later.
Mm-hmm.
And I can look at pictures, and I can talk to Bianca, and I can talk to a couple of our other friends in college, and they're like, you didn't eat.
Mm-hmm.
All you did
was so
thin. Have an energy drink and
Nas
a pill.
Nas and
Narco. Nas and Narco or like a vanilla Coke and a Xanax. Mm-hmm. And I needed it. And I didn't eat. I was like fine on my caffeine. Super caffeinated and super high all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my normal, and I was okay with it because I wasn't binge drinking. Granted, I drank. But I wasn't drinking to the extent that I used to be. I wasn't going out to the extent that I used to be. I wasn't partying.
And at that time, it was like, this is good for me because I no longer am in that place.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was, the relationship was kind of put on a pedestal of taking you out of this dark mess without realizing what you were in.
I was in another layer.
Doing grown-up drugs instead of party girl drugs.
I was still doing a lot of things that were not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because you said the same thing about your 7th, 8th grade relationship, about this, you know, adult relationship, this is what we do now.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's way later in life, totally different substance. But it was, again, that attachment of this is the thing that we do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't start them with him. You had gotten them previously. So can you take us back to that a little bit? Because I don't recall hearing where you first started with the
with my friends. Okay. They had it still.
Okay.
And it was more drinking at the time, but I was still able to do that.
Okay.
So, but once I got into that relationship with him, it was barely any drinking and just pills. And then I was like, how do you get so much? Like, how do you get it? And he was like, well, my doctor. So I went to the same doctor as him. I had anxiety, and I still do.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very easy for me to get Xanax. And then it was very easy for me to get Norco because I have scoliosis, so I just complained about my back. And if you look at my spine, you can see that it's not great.
Yeah.
So he was like, okay, Norco, yeah, you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that for probably a couple years, that prescription. So he had his, I had mine.
Yeah.
We both had it. We had a lot of it. I think that's why we did it so much. And I didn't really, but we did a lot of pills together. And that was what we did. Mm-hmm. And it was really just, instead of drinking so much, I would just get high off pills.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fed to me, like, woke up in the morning, here, mm-hmm. have this, here, do this. Feel like it was bad. I did know one time he didn't have a pill and he withdrew, just didn't have it for like 12 hours. And he was shaking and he couldn't sleep,
mm-hmm.
and he was sweating profusely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking, like, chill out, like, you're gonna get it in the morning, like, the pharmacy's gonna open in the morning. But that was him and his years and years and years of doing that.
Right.
I'm only in, you know, at that time I was probably only a year into, like, consistently doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I do always remember that moment, but I probably did it for a couple years. And it wasn't until I didn't have that doctor anymore and I couldn't get the refill, I went to another doctor and they were like, I'm not going to give you the Norco.
Mm-hmm.
You can get ibuprofen.
Yeah.
And if you want Xanax, you have to go to therapy. And I was like, well, this is really annoying. Like, I don't want to do all that. It's like doing too much for me. But again, I was out of that relationship when that happened. And the people that I were surrounded with were not doing those things. So it was just kind of easy for me to keep my mind occupied and not have to do those. I really do feel that my surroundings really affected my use.
Absolutely. And since you say that, and because your kind of party girl history in college is what made this relationship and the pill addiction not seem like a big issue, I want to step back a little bit and look at the transition from a senior in high school that didn't smoke, didn't drink, didn't do any of those things to, you know, sort of escalating in college. Your son was born somewhere in there, right?
Yes. He was born 2 years after high school.
Okay.
I did not go to CSUB until he was probably 2. So it had been like 4 years out of high school that I got into CSUB, and then I started doing those things.
And so you're a single mom at that point, right?
I don't remember when me and my son's father stopped being together. Maybe around 2 years, maybe 2 or 3 years.
Okay, and it was really just the friend group that you fell in with in college.
Yeah.
They were doing those things. They were like, here, let me show you.
Yeah.
Okay. And was that alcohol and drugs? What was that?
It really was just drinking.
Drinking.
At first. And then we would go, like, to concerts. Or we would go out of town, or mm-hmm. you would go hang out with people, and they had weed and they had pills, but they were very much, we were very much just like a drinking and a pill group.
Okay, and I know that you said you were living your best life. Is that how it felt? It felt celebratory? You weren't worried about it? It was really just partying?
Mm-hmm. I was not worried about anything. I drank. We would get 3 24, 32 packs
mm-hmm.
for each person. We would drink them all in the weekends. So I'm drinking 10, 12 beers a day, and I, zero care in the world, mm-hmm. did not worry about anything.
Okay.
I didn't think.
Did you ever, I'm sorry to interrupt, but did your mom ever come to mind during this phase?
No. I was living with her at the time,
yeah.
And I think she never really told me, like, chill out, because I would just, hey, you can watch my son, I'm going here. Like, I wasn't, they never really told me,
yeah.
No, like, come on, like, be a parent.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that was guilt or because she was drinking at the same time, too. But I wasn't really thinking of her actions.
I was just curious about that because you'd already had all of those experiences with her and the alcoholism, you know, and everything that she was going through, that I was curious to know if you ever thought about that during that time frame.
Mm-mm. And I think it's now that I looked back at it, was I was 18 and I got out of my dad's house because I wanted to escape.
Mm-hmm.
But the only place I could escape to was to my mom's house. So I went, you know, from one toxic household to another toxic household situation, just because I liked one more. One had more freedom than the other.
Yeah.
And it was never really me being surrounded by good influences, because she was still drinking when I was mm-hmm. drinking.
Okay, so mom's not saying anything. Friend group is, you know, helping you party.
Mm-hmm.
What about son's dad? Was he concerned at all? He was a driving force behind your sobriety for so long. Did he have anything to say?
Mm-mm. I don't think he realized.
Okay.
Because we weren't really together. He didn't realize how much I was doing. And whenever, on the weekends, if I was drinking like that,
mm-hmm.
my son would be with him.
Okay.
Because he's always had him on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like I was like a free...
Yeah.
Person with no kid and no worry in the world on the weekends.
It really just did feel like partying and mm-hmm. celebrating. Okay, that makes sense. So then you meet this older man and you're entering a relationship with him. At that point, did you realize that the party girl behavior was escalating and you wanted out of it? Were you getting tired of it? What happened there?
I was not in a good place, I think, for a long time, because that man was my friend's dad.
Okay.
So once I got into that relationship with him, I essentially lost my friends, okay. understandably, rightfully so. But he had saw me and saw what I was doing, and I think he knew that I was unhappy,
mm-hmm.
and he knew that wasn't the life that I wanted. I think I was just doing it. And I think he realized, like, how much his kids had an influence on me. And so it was more of, he knew that I wanted out of this life, and he, like, offered me a path to it, but I didn't think the path would be a relationship. I initially never thought, when we first would talk about anything, I didn't think that it was going to be a sexual love relationship.
And the way that it kind of stemmed is like he was putting you on this fitness journey too,
mm-hmm.
at that time. It's like, get healthy,
mm-hmm.
you know, I can help you, when essentially there was no health
mm-hmm.
at all. Like
mm-hmm.
you were you would run so much
mm-hmm.
and you wouldn't even eat.
Yeah.
You know, so in your mind at that time,
you were getting healthy.
Yeah.
And that was your happy.
Yeah.
But, okay, so we have older man who's helping you get healthy. You're assuming he's going to give you support, but instead it becomes, it sounds like maybe a little bit manipulative to become a romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. Okay, and how long did that relationship last?
A year.
A year? Okay, and then
let's not forget we know each other.
So. We were together for a year. We probably stayed hooking up. Been talking for several years.
Okay, and did the drug use continue through the duration of your contact?
It did for like the year that we were together and probably a year afterwards. It wasn't as much because I wasn't with him all the time and it was easy to get that extra supply from him when we're in a relationship. But we still did the pills when we were hooking up all the time.
Okay, and did you use substances when you weren't with him or was it strictly with him?
I used substances when I was not with him too.
Okay. So when did that stop?
Probably, let's say, a year or so after we broke up, a year and a half after we broke up.
And how old are you at that point?
Probably 25, 26, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
And why? Why did you stop using?
I couldn't get access easily. And again, the people that I were around were not doing it. So it wasn't like I felt the desire to do it because it wasn't around me. It really played a
It wasn't useful anymore. Mm-hmm. It wasn't useful to who you were at the time mm-hmm. with the people you were around at the time.
Okay, so you're 26, and it was that same doctor that told you no, that you could take ibuprofen and that you needed to go to therapy for
yes,
that?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So at 26, that relationship is officially over. Mm-hmm. You've had a doctor that's not going to enable you anymore.
Yeah.
And then do you decide to get clean? Are you like, I'm just not going to continue this behavior anymore?
I'm just not going to do it, and just because it wasn't available to me. And I've had pills since I've stopped using consistently.
Okay.
There's been times that my back's hurt and I've gotten an Orco or, you know, had an Orco given to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I take it and I'm like, holy mac and cheese, I'm super high.
Yeah.
And I don't like that feeling anymore. And I was like this all the time. So, uh-huh. And then the Xanax is more, if I do it, that high is very comforting for me,
mm-hmm.
and I don't like it. So, you know, whenever I've done therapy or anything in the past and they've asked me like, hey, we cannot give you this, like you're rightfully deserving mm-hmm. of a Xanax. I just can't do it. I just won't do it. It's too much of a connecting that part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
For me to start it over again.
Okay. So I guess what I'm trying to ask, and I definitely don't want to put you on the spot or make you feel called out, but a lot of times what we see is people that go from doctor shopping and then their doctor tells them no. And so then like that kind of starts them down the path of illicit drugs. So that would mm-hmm. be the point at which they introduce heroin or, you know, they're buying counterfeit pills, things like that. So there had to be something, or maybe there wasn't, something in your life that made you okay with that decision to stop instead of escalating. Like you had the choice. You could either de-escalate or escalate, and you chose to make the healthy decision.
I think probably money. Really, I think that's what it was. Subconsciously, I didn't want to pay for it.
Okay. I mean, money goes into a lot of things. That's building a better life for you and your son. Like I can absolutely see that being a motivating factor. At that point, were you still living with your mom?
I think at this point, my mom had moved out of town, and so it was me and my son and my stepdad. And that was another triggering thing, too, because I caught my mom trying to kill herself right before she moved out of town. And so the alcoholism, and her depression like really took a hold of her, and I really stopped doing a lot of things for a long time because when you catch your mom trying to kill herself, it was, and I wasn't even like, at that point I wasn't even traumatized, I was like more annoyed. I'm like, you're seriously trying to do this right now? Like, I can't even, I don't want to deal with this. This is ridiculous. I don't have to deal with this.
I think that was a big point though for you, like in life. Because I remember we were on the phone that night and it was just an annoyance of everything. Like, of everything past and everything present to that point. Like, you just didn't, it was just like, I don't want to live this way and I don't want to deal with this anymore either.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes a strong-willed person to be able to do that, because a lot of people can use that as escape as to why they continue using, but instead you chose not to.
Yeah.
But I think something that you've consistently said is it's because you didn't surround yourself with those types of people who were doing those things anymore. I mean, even when you were with that person.
Oh, man.
Yeah. you know, your core group of friends, we didn't support that necessarily.
No.
At all.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it was good because you still had that to fall back on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you knew you had that support. But I also, I'm hopeful that you'll speak a little bit about therapy and getting into that, because that was a huge turning point for you as well.
Yeah.
And learning to handle all of the trauma and feel like you didn't need to be with toxic people to deal with your trauma.
Therapy, I think, has been, I've gone in and out of therapy rightfully for my whole life. But I really don't think it took my late adulthood life to really get what I needed, which was to be real with myself and to be real with my actions and to be real with why I did all of these things that I did. I think I've used all of my life experiences as a lot of annoyance, like, oh, why does this have to happen to me? Like, oh my gosh, I had to be raped and then nothing comes out of it. Like, I shouldn't have said anything because that would have been, you know, less of a traumatic thing. Like, I'm just annoyed that I told anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm annoyed that my mom had a drink. Or I'm annoyed that my mom didn't love us enough to want to kill us. Like, I should have been living with her. I shouldn't have been living with my dad. I would have a better childhood if I was with my mom. Or I'm annoyed that I put myself in this situation. I think it was,
with so much self-guilt for things that you had no control over.
Mm-hmm. And I think it took a lot of realizing, like, obviously this is not my choice. I didn't get to choose my parents. I didn't get to choose my situation.
Right.
I didn't get to choose my life. But then I did choose certain things, and I chose my comforts based on my traumas and my experiences. And I, with men especially, I think that's my biggest issue in relationships. And even like my relationship that I'm in, it's not perfect, but my relationship before, it was picture perfect in my mind, but Bianca knew that it was not picture perfect. And I'm just searching for these things in life that I think are good for me.
You know, even then I felt like that was still a great point for you, because at that time, even though I knew that wasn't going to be your forever relationship, it was still a good starting point of, I want something that is healthy
and
for
good.
Yeah.
That was my first relationship.
That was an adult relationship.
That I had a man that listen to me, and I've never had a man that listened to anything about anything. I told my ex that I loved Disneyland and that I loved this, and I wanted to go skydiving, and I loved breweries, and I loved craft beer, and I wanted to, and he took me and did everything.
Mm-hmm.
We went to go, I told him Death Cab for Cutie was on my band bucket list. He bought me Death Cab for Cutie tickets. Like, this was the first time I had a man hear me and treat me like a person that, the way I treated people, I think. Mm-hmm. I was a giver, and I gave a lot of myself, and I gave a lot of my needs, and gave up a lot of myself for these relationships that were not giving me anything back. And that was the first relationship that I had a man that listened to me and did the minimal amount of things that that should have been in a relationship. Mm-hmm. So that gave me hope. But again, I was in a relationship where it was just not for me. It was not my person to be with. It was not my equal thoughts, yeah, equal anything. But I really feel like after therapy and after his relationship, after therapy too with that relationship, I realized that I'm searching for these things that I think I need, mm-hmm, not what I need.
Right.
I think I need that relationship. That was the perfect man for me. If I had a bucket list, mm-hmm, of the dream man, my Pinterest board of a man, that my ex-boyfriend was in. Mm-hmm. Everything that I ever wanted a man. Looks, money, the way he treated me, that was it. But he was not my person. He was not for me. Our views were different. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until therapy that I realized, like, you think that's perfect and that looks perfect. But with therapy, I realized, like, those things that I was searching, I feel like I was searching for a lot of the things that I missed out on. I searched, especially with men, I searched for those things that I missed out on in my childhood. I didn't have a good example of how a man should treat you. Mm-hmm. So I was settled for a man that gave me minimal attention. I settled for a man that we could do these things together, because that was our thing that we did together. And I think subconsciously, maybe because of rape, that was something that we did, just me and him. I was searching for these things in my partner that just me and him did.
Mm-hmm. That's valid.
And how exciting to, you know, in your late 20s, discover that there's so much more than that, you know, that,
yeah,
you can express a need and have somebody fill it. Because I think in your formative years, it wasn't that you were settling for somebody who gave you those things. You literally did not know that somebody could give you more,
yeah,
than that. You had never, mm-hmm, seen that. So, I mean, that's like the greatest thing about therapy, is you have someone to put all those things into perspective for you, to tell you, like, you get to keep what you want and throw away what you don't. So find the person that has the good things and not the bad things.
Yeah.
And that's so helpful. Where do you want to go from there?
I think we're good. I think
If you're good on the developmental stuff, I definitely want to go to maintaining sobriety.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a huge thing. I think that's a huge thing for you. So for the history of your use, you have always known that it's about the people you surround yourself with.
Yeah.
That if you're around people that are using and around people that party, you will do the same.
Mm-hmm.
So in maintaining your sobriety, beyond surrounding yourself with good people, how do you stay sober?
I think probably just being real about what it does for me. Again, I've told you that there's been times when I've had a pill or two,
right, mm-hmm,
and I know that that doesn't make me feel the best anymore, and I know what it led me, what path it led me on. It really, not just being surrounded, but I really, being out of it makes me take a look at what's in front of me and what I appreciate in my life now. Mm-hmm. And seeing what's important to me is more important to me than being high for like an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have people in your life that you care for that much, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you're learning that.
Yeah.
And you've learned that.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing. Were there any resources that helped you along the way?
I don't think I was really delusional, I think, to how bad I was. Mm-hmm. And I think if you, I've had conversations with Bianca about it later on, and she was like, you didn't think we knew? Like,
that's a hard, I mean, it's a really fine line, like, when, like, for us, we've been friends for a really long time, mm-hmm. to be real and honest, and then you get that pushback, you know, mm-hmm. and you still want to try to be as supportive as you can, and that's something that people have to deal with when it comes to substances and addiction, is understanding that and trying to find a way to maintain that relationship or mm-hmm. that friendship, and just hoping that it's going to work out yeah. in the end, because you lose so much, you lost so much, and that's really difficult. And it's hard for me to interview and not say stuff at the same time and let you tell your story too, because like for me, I felt like one of the biggest things for you was the free therapy at CSUB.
Yeah.
That's a huge resource, and I was like, I hope she says that thing. And I'm like trying to, I don't want to do that. I don't want to take your story, but I think it's so important for people to know. Yeah. So could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I didn't know, and it's crazy that I didn't realize you're spending thousands of dollars for mm-hmm. school, and they have so much that you could do. And after I think I went to therapy, I'm like, you know that there's, like, you can go talk to a counselor.
Get
like
an appointment every 2 weeks.
Yep. Like, yeah. You're already paying for it. Like, you can go. But that really, he helped me a lot. Just to listen, to talk to somebody, and then have somebody be like, hey, that's kind of messed up. Like, that's not normal. Mm-hmm. Like, you realize that that's not normal. I'm like, no. Like,
did you see Dr. Harville?
Huh?
Did you see Dr. Harville? Dr. Michael Harville? Bald guy? White?
No.
Okay. No. I was, like, so excited for him.
He was younger. He was a younger guy. I can't remember
what his name is. Yeah. Sorry, because I'm just like, please just mention it.
I absolutely love that you brought that up, because, I mean, that's not something I ever would have thought to mention, too, but I have used a counseling service at CSUB, and they're amazing, mm-hmm. and it's free, and people don't know that they're there. Mm-hmm. So thank you, definitely, for bringing that up.
And it was so easy. Like, it was so simple to just be like, hey, yep. This is what, can I talk to somebody? Yep. Yeah. Here you go. And I think, I don't know, but back then, when you looked on the counseling website, you could see like, hey, this person is kind of like, their specialty is this kind of mm-hmm. thing. They're this person. So when I went to choose, essentially, I guess they can put you with whoever, but mm-hmm. I chose that person because I can't remember what specialty he had. But I'm like, that's probably the most mm-hmm. effective person to talk to.
I love that, because you can research and you don't have to be stuck with whoever you feel like has been given to you mm-hmm. when it comes to therapy. A lot of times people get assigned, especially youth, can be assigned to certain people, and it may or may not be a good fit. You know, so it is important to know that you can look things up depending on what is going on with the person to see who might best fit their needs.
Right. It's really, therapy is probably something that's so stigmatized and not talked about mm-hmm. enough. And I think it's huge, because if you're not talking about it and you're like, you know what, this is a big deal for me to go call somebody to talk about my life and my insecurities and my trauma, and then they go there and it doesn't work out, or that person they don't vibe with, or they don't feel like they're being heard, then they could be scared out of that forever.
Right.
Because we're not talking about, hey, maybe if that person doesn't work out, try another person. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't realize that you can try again and try again and try again until you find somebody that can help you and hear you.
Right. I wanted to ask, because you have a 10-year-old son now, mm-hmm. right? So how do you talk to your son about substances?
I think he's always been like, ugh, he hates when I drink at all.
Right.
If I have a beer, like, he's like, ugh, mom. This is why you look the way you do, because you have you're drinking beer because you have a beer belly. He's never liked it. And I told him, I said, you know, like, I've done some of those things.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, you? Like, looks at me like, you're my mom. Like, no, those are bad things. And I'm like, some of the things aren't the worst things in the world, but mm-hmm. it's true that people that you know can do it, and it's a thing. I think I am struggling with the conversation because I don't want him to be like me in the sense of not having that open conversation
right.
with him. I didn't realize when I was younger my dad was a huge pothead.
Mm-hmm.
God forbid if he ever caught me doing half the things that I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a hypocrite and doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what I thought of now that I'm older. So I don't want my son to think that I'm perfect and I haven't smoked weed or I haven't, he knows I drink or haven't done these things because I have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to come up in life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I don't want to lie to him and think that it's not normal or it's not, you're not going to be in a situation where you're around it. I just don't want to lie to him.
Mm-hmm.
But lying takes away a lot of credibility. So it's good. It's a difficult conversation to have. But as parents, sometimes we struggle with the line of how much is too much and what do they need to know versus what doesn't matter or, mm-hmm. you know, what we think doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the biggest things is lying. You lose all credibility when you lie.
Absolutely.
So even if it's a difficult conversation to have, I think you're doing a great job with saying, you know, I don't know how to talk about it sometimes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we're having the conversation if the conversation comes up.
Mm-hmm.
Appropriately, of course.
I don't think he realizes the other thing. Just I think he just thinks weed and drinking right now. But that's a conversation that I want to have, especially because my advice wasn't, you know, meth or heroin or
right.
anything.
Mm-hmm.
It was pills, and I essentially did get some from my doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that I want to have a conversation with him about because those are things that were prescribed to me. And we do think of doctors as being healers and helpers
mm-hmm.
with our health, but, you know, having that access was, you know, not good for me, but that's an access that I got from my doctor, and that's something that, God forbid, something happens to him and he needs pain medication or
what happened to that doctor, by the way? Sorry, because you said he was there and then he wasn't anymore.
I think he retired or something.
Oh,
because
okay.
He was old. He's an older man.
Okay.
So he was like,
curious.
yeah,
because
he had been my ex-boyfriend's doctor for 20, 30 years at that point.
Oh, wow. And so this would have been in, like, the early 2000s, right?
No, it would have been, like, 2010s.
Yeah. Okay.
2000.
Oh, I'm so good at math. Like, 2010s. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So that was whenever we started to see a lot of change
yeah.
around opioids. I was going to say, like, in the early 2000s, there wasn't anything. But, like, 2010s would be, like, the start of the big pharma
yeah,
smackdowns.
I was curious, like, did he retire or did he
get busted?
Get retired,
right?
Or, you know, so...
So I think as parents, it puts us in a unique place to kind of make sure our kids have the things that we didn't have, right?
Yeah.
So he's really close to the age you were whenever you started experimenting with
mm-hmm.
things. So the whole theme of this podcast is to make sure that we're able to learn from past experiences and kind of create a world in which kids don't have to learn the hard way. So if you could make one change or one recommendation to prevent substance use, what would it be? What should we be doing?
I think educating the easiness of it all. It's so easy
mm-hmm.
and so quick to be caught up into something that you never thought you would be caught up in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so easy and so quick to get access to a lot of these things. And I'm sure you guys hear about, oh yeah, this, it was right here, or it was super easy, or I could have,
mm-hmm.
you know, I just went down the street, or my uncle knew somebody, or it's so easy to get access to it. I think that I didn't think it was easy when I was a kid.
Right.
I didn't think that drugs were as easy to get when I was younger. I thought it was like this thing and I had to know somebody and knock on the door and the little spider came out and they looked at me and I had to say a passcode to get access to these drugs. But it was so easy to get.
Right.
Okay, let me ask you this though, because the struggle that we have as educators is that parents don't want us telling their kids that it's easy. Mm-hmm. So as a parent, you know, what would your advice be to us in educating? Because we get a lot of pushback sometimes when it comes to things like that on what exactly we're saying to youth and how we say it.
It's very, I don't know if the word ignorant or selfish would be the word to think that the times that we live in right now are not terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to our kids and access to stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that because parents maybe were born into a time and their time was different than our kids, the things have changed. And maybe it's because I'm a younger mom.
Mm-hmm.
It's really frustrating to speak with other parents to think that it's not happening,
right?
Or it's not right there and it's not easy for our kids
mm-hmm.
to get it, because it's super easy. And if they have a cell phone, it's probably easier.
Right.
And I think we're parents, especially when we're not wanting to address the fact that it's so easy and it could happen, and it could happen to your kid, and it could be in your neighborhood, or it could be in your family, or any of that. I think that's the issue, and I think parents don't want to admit that,
mm-hmm.
that it's so easy.
Right.
And they want to believe that their kids are not going to be influenced, and they want right. to believe that their kids are not hanging out with those kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's super, it's there, and yeah. it's real, right. and it's tough to think about.
So I think parental education is the other component of that, is what we're hearing. And I think the other thing that your story really highlights for us is it's happening a lot younger than we mm-hmm. think too. Like
mm-hmm.
everybody wants to talk about their high school kid, but that's when you're starting yeah. to see signs and symptoms, and it's been going on for a while. Yeah. We need to be talking to fifth and sixth graders
yeah.
for the pressures that they're going to be receiving in seventh and eighth mm-hmm. grade. I think that that's an excellent point.
And I think these kids, I've gone to my son's school and I look at these sixth graders and I'm like, bro, you're tall. You look way more yeah. older than I right. did. And I think it's the time, mm-hmm. obviously. But we're treating our kids a lot too as older mm-hmm. than yes. what they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I look at my son and he's almost as tall as me, and I'm like, I have to take a step back and be like, bro, you're 10. Like, mm-hmm. you're 10. Like, you don't need a cell phone right now. Like, you need right. to just chill out for a bit. I need to take a step back and realize, like, oh my gosh, you're only 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I need to stop thinking that you're older than what you are. But then I also need to do the fine line of realizing that other kids his age are probably around older things, mm-hmm. and I need right. to think about that too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mixture of wanting them to stay their appropriate age and preparing them for things that the world is going to prepare them for regardless.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and hoping that they make the right decision along the way.
Right.
Is let me tell you what's real, let me tell you what's out there without overexposing you to it,
mm-hmm.
because you're going to be exposed to it, even though I don't know to what extent, it's hard.
I think the scare factor, though, with parents, I think that's probably toxic. That's probably absolutely. My number one thing
yes.
is being scared
yeah.
to tell my dad anything.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't ever want my son to feel scared to tell me, hey, mom, I messed up, I did this, or I drank a little bit too much, or mm-hmm. I did this, because then we're unaware as parents. then we're putting ourselves in a bad situation because we're not giving our kids the feeling that they can come and talk to us when these circumstances happen. I can't guarantee my kid's not gonna do anything. Mm-hmm. I just hope that he trusts me enough to feel that if he does so do something, that he can come to me and I can guide him mm-hmm. through that moment in his life.
I love that. It's not that my kid would never. It's the my kid is going to get to an age to make his decisions. Hopefully he includes me in those, whatever the outcome is.
Well, and I really like that you put it in the perspective of redefining what is age appropriate too, because you're right, our kids are more connected and have more access to mm-hmm. any generation ever before them. And I had never truly considered that by, you know, saying my kid's only 9, like he's not going to be exposed to that, that also closes off communication between mm-hmm. us. If I haven't introduced adult topics into conversation with my kid, then they don't think that they can reciprocate and talk to me about right. adult things. And I had truly never considered that before. You're trying to shelter them, but really you're isolating them.
Yeah.
So that's such an excellent point. And now I'm going to go have a drug talk with my son. 7's not too early. We're going to do it.
Yeah. It's a conversation too, not only with drugs and
absolutely,
but also, you know, some of the trauma that I dealt with in my life.
Yeah.
It wasn't a convert. I mean, I knew and I did the steps, but I didn't tell my parents.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? I didn't. So we need to have that open conversation with drugs, alcohol, mm-hmm. Sexual
sure
things.
Open, you know, it's not open-ended. It has to stay open.
Right.
It's not the one and done.
It's a conversation that needs to be always yeah. reintroduced and refresh and brought up over and over again because things change. I think we're going to go through things and see that the way drugs and alcohol and stuff happens, it changes, like it's mm-hmm. changed
mm-hmm.
from 20 years ago to now. It's only going to continue to change.
Right. Well, and I kind of want to give you props for that because one of the benefits of kids being more connected is that they have the outlet to hear stories like yours, to know mm-hmm. that, you know, this has happened to other people, that you're going to be okay, that you're going to come out on the other side, and this is one way you can deal with it, and these are the things that will come from that, versus feeling alone and isolated and like that's never happened to anybody before.
Yeah.
So when survivors of addiction and abuse share their stories, you empower all of the generations that come after you. And as hard as those things are to talk about and as hard as it is to hear, you make a difference every time you tell that story. And mm-hmm. we're so, so thankful to have you here doing that with us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think we're good. Again, want to thank you for coming and being willing to do this and share your experience with us. It's much appreciated, and I know that it's going to make an impact. I know that it will.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.